John Michael Kofi was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. His father had a business there, a successful business, but the family's life was interrupted when a spate of violence forced them to flee the country. John Michael is now 20 years old, and he's been living as a refugee since he was 11. His family first fled to Malawi and then to Swaziland, and while he was attending high school there, John Michael got a scholarship to attend school in Germany, and from there, another to study here in Vancouver at UBC. But it wasn't easy getting into either Germany or Canada. John Michael's parents are still living in Swaziland, and John Michael himself is studying at UBC as an international student with a refugee travel document. He's written a book about his experiences as a refugee in several different countries. It's called Refugee, The Journey Much Desired. And there's a dash between the two E's in refugee to emphasize the refuge part. I talked to John Michael earlier, and I started by asking him what the word refugee means to him.
If you would ask me the question in 2009 when I first arrived in Malawi, because my family first arrived in the refugee camp in Malawi, I would have given a different answer as compared to now. The whole idea of a refugee, it's someone who is seeking a refuge. That would be the basic way I can explore that. And it's actually something which is not normally talked about. When people are talking about refugees, normally they just look at the people aspect of it. They don't look at the place, the condition that the person, the refugee himself, is seeking.
That refuge.
Yes, yeah. The refuge.
Why did you and the family have to leave DRC? And what was life like during those years for you and the family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that forces me to dig back into my childhood. But, of course, it was very unstable. For me as a child, I really did not understand much. Life is like normal. You go to school, there are bombs in the background. You hear people dying, a lot of kidnappings going on, but you never really understand as a child. So now that I look back, when I read news, when I'm reading books related to the conflict there, it's when I kind of form my perspective on what was going on. I'm like, oh, actually, my classmate who was kidnapped back when I was 8 years old to join the child soldiers, this is what was going on. So I never understood then.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was there something that finally forced you all to leave and go to Malawi?
Yes. My family was targeted. And actually, my father's estate was set on fire. So that was the sign that we should probably move.
So what were conditions like then in Malawi when you were there? Where were you living?
Yeah, we arrived in the refugee camp. It's called the Dzarika refugee camp. It's one of the largest in southern Africa. Conditions were terrible. Yeah, we had absolutely no one. We had nothing. So having to undergo through the camp management checks, you know, where do we sleep? We didn't have a house, we didn't have a home. In the first few days, though, one thing I realized is that, yeah, people in the same precarious situations often care for each other. And that's exactly what you experience, because after a couple of nights sleeping outside, the refugees who were already living there, who were established, like started pointing, yeah, as to the right direction, saying, oh, you might actually find an empty, dilapidated building that you can renovate. And that's how we started establishing our lives there. It wasn't easy because we did not have many connections, but different people coming to, like, say, oh, this is what you can do, this is what you can do, it did help. And also, my family was a large family. I have two elder brothers and my father. So I can say we were kind of hustlers, because we started to, like, figure out how we can really establish our lives. We reconstructed a destroyed site where people were living previously. We were building bricks for ourselves, and just we started from nothing.
And how old were you then?
I was 11 when we arrived in Malawi.
I mean, I can't imagine how your lives changed from from where you were living with all the chaos, but in a settled home situation, to suddenly having to start from absolutely nothing to build a life.
The irony in that, actually, I realized that in Zarika refugee camp, I found it more peaceful, more calm, even though life was much more challenging because we had nothing and we had to start from zero. For me, it was much more tranquil, and I liked it better.
So why did you leave Malawi then and go to Swaziland?
Well, it's essentially the same story. The only difference is the geographical place and probably the intensity. After 1 year and a half, I went to high school. I worked really hard, went to the best high school in the country, the Kuni Boys Secondary School. It's an all-boys school. And that kind of decreased burden for my parents as well. Later on, my father established himself in one of the towns in the southern part of Malawi, trying to start some business. But then in 2012, things really escalated politically. The president, the Malawian president, passed away as well, mysteriously. And xenophobic attacks started, and most of the time the refugee shops were the ones targeted. My father's shop was robbed again and we couldn't handle it anymore. That's when my family decided again maybe it might be better to seek a new refuge.
And what was the situation there when they arrived?
The situation in Swaziland was probably much worse than actually in Malawi when we arrived. The refugee camp in Malawi, compared to the refugee camp in Swaziland, it's very interesting because the one in Malawi is quite large, many people, very multicultural. The one in Swaziland is very small. By small, we are looking at around 1,000 people, let's say, maybe 150 families or so. These are just rough estimates, I'm not sure. So it forces everyone to be compacted together as compared to the Malawian one where we are spread. So there is no sense of privacy, which means if you are in a bad situation, like our arrival, when you have nowhere to sleep, have nothing to eat, it affects you even more because you see that everyone is looking at you. Everyone can see that.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you go with the family then too? Did you have to leave high school?
I had to. One of my regrets, actually, maybe not anymore because now I'm at like one of the world's best universities, UBC. When we arrived in Swaziland, my deepest regret was having to leave Likuni Boys Secondary School because I saw a future there. And it's also one thing I really explore in my book because my book focuses a lot on education, the lack of education for refugees, the poor quality education, lack of education opportunities. Once we finish high school, there is nowhere else to go. Like I get a lot of messages from time to time from my friends in Malawi and in Swaziland saying, John Michael, in scholarship opportunities, really, there is nothing. It's one in a thousand who gets a wonderful opportunity like the United World Colleges giving me a scholarship, and then that's my only way of escaping that reality. So having to leave Rikuni Boys was affected me the most, more than anything.
So then when you were in Swaziland, what happened then? Started again?
Yes.
Started again from scratch?
Yeah.
And then what?
One of the ironies, again, there were orphans living in the camp, and these orphans are the ones who actually took care of my family. So they would cook at night for the next, 2 weeks or so, until my elder sister moved out of the camp and from on Wednesdays and Thursdays and started selling secondhand clothes in the market so that we can generate some income, which later was used to buy some supplies for the family.
But it was these orphans who had nothing.
Yes.
Who lent that, lent a hand.
Yes.
And you wonder where they are now, maybe?
Yeah, I don't think they're in Swaziland anymore. might be that they are in Maputo in Mozambique, but I'm not sure, because our paths have kind of diverged.
Right. That's the other thing, isn't it? Like you say, you're thrown together in a place and you make connections, and then suddenly everything is kind of blown apart again, like over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so disorienting.
It's very, very disorienting.
So, but then you got back to school.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Out of all the nostalgia of Likuni Boys Secondary School, of course, I was trying to find a boarding school, which is missionary school, because Likuni Boys was a missionary school. I couldn't. You know, when you move from place to place as refugees, you don't have time or even ways of collecting the appropriate documentation.
Right.
So making a transition like that is really hard. So the schools couldn't offer me a place, and I resorted to going to the nearest school, Mbaga High School. It's very close to the refugee camp, and yeah, it's a very rural school, very limited resources, but I had to manage somehow. That was the only option I had. I had to lie about my education level, because I did not want to go back, repeat the same class which I had finished. And that worked for me, of course. The trade-off, I had to work extra harder so that I maintain the results, the good results which can propel me forward in the future.
This is my conversation with John Michael Kofi. He's an undergraduate student at University of British Columbia, and he's the author of Refugee, The Journey Much Desired. And we'll continue that conversation after 8:30, after the news here at 8:30. Now the time is 20 minutes before 9, before 10 Mountain Time. We're going back to my conversation with John Michael Kofi. He's a student at the University of British Columbia and the author of a new book about his experiences as a refugee in several different countries, starting from the age of 11. John Michael's family fled the Democratic Republic of Congo for Malawi, and then to Swaziland, where he attended high school. He worked hard. He was very, very disciplined, and before long was one of the top 10 students in the country. And even when he had to leave that high school and go to a small rural school, he continued to work very, very hard, push himself. And he was offered scholarships to two prestigious schools, the United World College in Germany and the African Leadership Academy in South Africa. So I talked to him about how he made the choice. But first I wanted to know where that drive came from, how he managed to work so hard in spite of everything to put himself in a better position.
I adore my father more than any other person in the world, because my father influenced me a lot. He is the one who was always there giving me advice. Out of all the misery, he would always take time to understand me. Differently from maybe most of the refugees, I would say I'm very lucky to have both my parents still alive and still caring. Because for most of my friends, it's either they actually came unaccompanied, so they are unaccompanied children, or else if they do have parents, their parents have given up on life. So if a child goes to school, well, you don't care. What's the use of school anyway if you will end up dying in the refugee camp, you know? But that was different for me. My father cherishes education. One of the things which makes him sad is the fact that my elder brothers and sisters did not have opportunities to progress with higher education. But for me, he tried to make me an exception, because as my brothers and sisters were hustling, trying to cater for the family, then they made sure that I actually had to go in school, which is different, because in Malawi, actually, I was young. I'm the youngest in my family, but still, I was kind of the one trying to hustle to make sure that my family survives.
Right.
But once we arrived in Swaziland, it changed. So I was in school and the rest of the family members were cheering for me. So that also gave me a huge motivation, because I did not want to disappoint them. I wouldn't mind disappointing myself, but disappointing my family, looking at how much sacrificing they are doing for me to get education, no matter how poor it is. No, it wasn't one of my choices, no.
Right, that was it. Mm. Huh. So from that, you did manage, like you say, to get these scholarships.
Yeah, it was amazing. Both institutions, which I really wanted to be part of, they gave me the scholarships, and it was hard to choose.
Yeah.
Especially because I was thinking Germany is the best option. I get to be exposed to a whole new world, the United World College. It's like you have the whole world in one place. So I wanted to go there. But then I was looking at it. I'm a refugee. I don't have any travel document. I have to engage the Swazi government to get proper documentation. If I do choose UWC and this doesn't work, then... Yeah.
You've closed the other door.
I've closed the other door already. Whereas if I had to choose African Leadership Academy in South Africa, it's easy to be smuggled across the border. Obviously, these were my thoughts, but I don't know if it would have worked because this is a reputable institution, so they wouldn't want to engage in something illegal. But yeah, I was used to being smuggled across the border.
that was the form of the way of life, yeah.
Yes. So eventually I settled for UWC and I said, well, what come, what may, yeah, life is just what it is. And I embarked on the journey of trying to find the travel document. I had some people in the Ministry of Home Affairs who were really willing to support, but the bureaucracy itself and the nature of my identity complicated things. So I applied for the travel document. The first one they gave me was rejected by the German embassy.
Hmm.
Eventually, they gave me 5 years after like 2 months and a half trying to apply.
So nerve-wracking and bewildering.
Yes.
Yeah, where to turn next? How to take another angle on this?
Yeah. And then after that, I had to start applying for the German visa, which also took eternity to be provided. I had to travel to South Africa with my new travel document, which was fine. But then afterwards, whatever happened, I have no idea. One of the conversations I had with a U.S. ambassador to Swaziland, she said, if you are planning to go to Germany and you are applying for the visa, it will be hard as a refugee. But it will be harder even as a Congolese refugee.
Huh.
Yes. For some reasons, I don't know why, it's like my people are cursed. So I was expecting that, but I wasn't expecting it to take as long as it did. I got the visa a day before my scheduled flight to Germany.
Whoa.
So it's a conversation I had with my father and my mom. I had already given up, so to say. I was like, no, this is not going to work out. Went to Mbabane, the capital city of Swaziland, hoping either to get the visa, the passport and the visa, or else to write to my school and say, cancel the flight or reschedule it to a later date. But yeah, when I arrived there, she gave me a glass of water and said, yeah, relax, it's on its way. It will be here in 3 hours. And that was probably the best news of all. So that's how I ended up in Germany. Started a new journey, a new world for me.
That must have been such a thing to end up, like you say, after all of that, to be in Germany, to be at that, working in that kind of level of academic excellence.
But like I always tell my friends, you know, when you talk about this kind of hardships, the setbacks, it makes you enjoy life more once you get an opportunity to enjoy life.
if you maintain that attitude, I could imagine some people would become quite angry and bitter about the whole deal.
Yeah.
So how's it been going then, being at UBC?
It's good. It's good.
Another hurdle to get here.
Another hurdle. The Canadian embassy denied me the study permit. That was another huge deal because I had actually rejected a good scholarship offer by Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. decided to come to Canada, obviously the political atmosphere in the US is not something I wanted to engage with. So coming to UBC was hard. Once I made it here, again, it was a huge exhilaration for me. I kind of celebrated because it was also a new life. It's been good. I'm enjoying my academics. I'm enjoying the Canadian people, very friendly. And generally, Vancouver, it's just amazing.
What's it like for you when you hear, and this comes up in the news a lot lately, and I mean, we've been hearing a lot about, you know, the whole situation with the Americans and children separated from parents, and, you know, this whole fear of, oh, refugees are going to overrun our country. What is it like for you to hear that when you have faced the challenges of moving from one place to another along with everything else? What's it like for you to hear that, John Michael?
Funny enough, this morning, actually, I was working on a blog post on my website, and I was exploring how reports about refugees are most of the time just about statistics, and there is nothing substantive, something the audience would actually learn from and maybe be willing to help. So normally that's the attitude I read news with or read the reports with. I know from my experience, no one will be able to capture the experience exactly as it is. We can report about the world now having 68.5 million refugees, but really, every one single individual from those 68.5 million has had a different, completely different and challenging, arduous journey to be where they are and to be called refugees. And for me, it annoys me somehow because that can't be captured in the media, which was one of the also motivations to write this book, actually, because I want to share at least some aspects of my experiences.
As you told this story, I was just thinking, like you say, about all the other young people who were your contemporaries who didn't have the family support, didn't have the encouragement, didn't have the personal resources to fight and fight and fight to make a future, and they're just left to the side.
Yeah, it's very heartbreaking. Actually, while on that, you know, I realize that in the Western world right now, suicide is a huge thing. Mental problems are affecting a lot of young people. And it might not come as a surprise to say that just 3 days ago, I was talking to one of my friends who has been contemplating suicide as a result. It's like, no, I see no way. I dropped out of school because no one wanted to educate me. My parents are helpless. My parent is helpless, and I am helpless. I can't even get a job to survive because I haven't completed high school. What's the use? So those are some of the stories that I have to face each and every day talking to my friends, because as much as I'm like thousands miles away, I try to be there for them.
Right.
At least social media has made that easy. So my friends, really, they have it tough. I still have it tough because even me being here in Canada, it's very hard to find someone who can relate to me personally, to my experiences. Sometimes I avoid talking about myself because I have this assumption that sometimes people won't understand me, or else they won't want to hear what I want to say. So it's really hard. It's hard. But at least I have a platform, my book, getting an opportunity like this to talk, to engage the Canadian audience, the Canadian readers. My friends do not. They are just lonely and, yeah, wondering whether they are going to survive the next day.
Hmm. And they're mostly still in Swaziland, are they? Or?
Yeah. Most of them. Some have migrated to Maputo in Mozambique. That's where some economic opportunities are. Because they can work in different shops as assistants, regardless of their education level. Plus, there is also a big migrant community. Some of them have gone to South Africa, but of course, they still do face some form of xenophobia from time to time. But most of them are still in the camp. in Swaziland.
And your brothers and your sister? Where are they?
Yeah, they are working in Maputo as well.
Right.
Yeah.
What, from your experience, your firsthand experience, your knowledge of this, what could change to make these situations better? Are there some fundamental, are there some things that could change fairly, I don't know, readily? Or is it something that would take a huge, huge, I don't know, sea change?
Well, talking about changes, it's where do you start, you know? That's something to think about. But for me, I personally believe primarily we need to get informed. Because if the public is not well informed or if it's misinformed, then they will hardly take any form of action. So we talk a lot about the Syrian refugee crisis. We are now talking about the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, the South Sudanese. The experiences they are having, like I said, they are very unique. But if we just consume the normal media reports, which contains just the statistics, then we just look at the statistics and we forget the lives which the statistics represent. So I believe the first step is to get informed. For those who are working in news agency, to ensure that the stories that they are bringing to the audience are quality stories. Once that is done, then maybe you can look at the political aspect of changes. Because speaking from experience, the Democratic Republic of Congo, what it's experiencing right now is a political crisis, not necessarily conflicts. Because the world has continually overlooked this, because mostly it's the countries in power, like the mightier countries, who are benefiting from the exploitation going on there. So the politicians have no interest in ending conflicts, which in return is producing refugees.
Right.
Yeah. So if the audience, the general public was to get well informed such that they know the root causes of these problems, like the public can start holding governments accountable. And also multilateral organizations like the United Nations can maybe start to get more calls to maybe focus more on what's important in terms of how they are doing things, how they are trying to resolve the conflicts.
I want to ask you one more thing before I let you go. And I'd love to know what's next for you when you finish up at UBC?
That's probably a question I need to ask my arts advisor. But yeah, I'm hoping to do international relations and probably with a minor in creative writing. I realize that I'm growing, so this might change tomorrow.
Yes.
But yeah, by the time I graduate from UBC, at least I hope that I can be well positioned enough to either be in a functioning organization, working for an organization, most preferably here in Canada, and just to see how I can best assist the people whom we share these kind of stories. I'm very interested in youth empowerment. I'm passionate about youth empowerment and obviously refugee issues, which is the reason why I'm trying to use this book as a tool to also reach many people who can assist the youth in the different refugee camps I've lived in and beyond.
Thank you for your time today. I hope we get a chance to talk again. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is John Michael Kofi. He's 20 years old. I've just posted a photo from when he was in the studio for our conversation. And I've also posted a link to his website as well. And you can find out about the book and the author. And he's got a blog. And besides writing and doing all these things he's done, he also plays guitar and writes songs. So going to have him back. Love to have him back to talk about that one of these times. And John Michael right now is a student at the University of British Columbia. And the book is called Refugee, and there's a hyphen between the two E's in Refugee, A Journey Much Desired. Brian Dance is here with some news headlines. And speak.